How old is he? 71? Oh, I'm sorry, you began a bit earlier. All right, yeah, I see now. Yeah.
For the Athenians, who had their whole fortune staked in their galleys, were in such a fear of the event as they had never been in the life, and were thereby of necessity to hold the fight upon the water with very different passions. For the sight being near, and not looking all of them upon one and the same part, he that saw their own side prevail took heart and felt their calling upon their gods.
Well, let us stop his power, which would seem to be to distinguish heart with difficulty from omnipotence, but he does not use here the term omnipotence yet, because he cannot speak of omnipotence because of the dualism of principles, yeah? God and matter. Omnipotence alone, we can say, would lead to unqualified goodness of creation and therefore of original man. But if there are two principles, there cannot be unqualified goodness of the world and of man in his original state. Differently stated, a non-omnipotent being cannot be simply good, but it can at most pursue its good only with the least harm to others. In the next paragraph, we cannot read it. God owes happiness to the just. This is now we turn around. Since God is now declared to be omnipotent and therefore perfectly good and capable of being perfectly just, he owes happiness to the just. This is clear. You see, if there is another power called matter, then the unhappiness of the just may very well be due to the limited power of God, who wishes to be just but cannot do it because of the resistance of matter. But if God is omnipotent, he can be just, and providence, the conflict between providence and the power of evil must be faced. God owes happiness to the just, but look at the prosperity of the wicked. The solution, immortality, just dispensation after death. Immortality is theoretically possible because of the duality of the substances and morally necessary. And this is pursued in the sequel. If you turn to page 246, paragraph 2. Where we cannot read, let me see, yeah. But what is that life after death? Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah.
Is the soul of man in its nature immortal?
You see, this was a question long discussed in former times. Is immortality natural to the soul, or is the soul immortal only by virtue of divine promise? Yeah, by divine promise. And so this is the question to which he refers. Yes.
I know not. My finite understanding cannot hold the infinite. What is called eternity eludes my grasp.
What is called infinite, the opposite experience than those who are doing evil?
Oh.
Yeah.
Anyway, don't you think that good and evil, fortune, are opposite conditions? I do. Then since these are mutually opposed, the relation between them must be the same as that between sickness and health. Obviously, a man is not going to be sick and well at the same time, or be simultaneously free of both health and disease. How's that? Take as an illustration any part of the body you like. I suppose a man may have a disease of the eyes called ophthalmia. Of course. And while his eyes are sick, they can't be well at the same time. Well, they can't, not at all.
So, good. And Socrates enlarges, generalizes on that. That's in the case of all good things, it is so that we cannot possess the specific good and its specific opposite at the same time, or get rid of the specific good and its specific opposite at the same time. What about pleasure and pain? And in C6.
Then let us return to our former admissions. Did you say that hunger was pleasant or painful? By hunger, I mean the state itself. Painful, it is. However, pleasant to eat when one is hungry. I understand. Yet hunger itself is painful, is it not? I agree. And thirst also. Very. Then must I go further with my questions? Or do you admit that every sort of want and desire is painful? I admit it without further questions. Good. But you do admit, don't you, that drinking when one is thirsty is pleasant? I do. And this phrase of yours, when one is thirsty, implies pain. Yes. But drinking is the satisfaction of a want. It is a pleasure. Yes. So you affirm that pleasure is felt in the act of drinking. Certainly. When one is thirsty, at least, I agree. While one feels pain? Yes. Then do you see the consequence of this? You were declaring that pleasure and pain are felt at the same time when you say that a man drinks when he is thirsty. Or does this not occur at the same time or place, whether in the soul or the body, as you prefer? I fancy there is here no difference. Is this so? Is it not? It is. Yet you state that it is impossible for a man to fare well and ill at the same time. Yes, and I say so again. But you have admitted that it is possible to feel pleasure while in pain. Looks that way. Then to feel pleasure is not to fare well, nor is to feel pain to fare badly. And the result of this is that what is pleasant is different from what is good.
Now, what is the nerve of the argument? The good and its opposite, it cannot subsist at the same time in the same respect. But the pleasant and its opposite can subsist at the same time in the same respect. And also getting rid. You get rid of the pain of hunger and the pleasure of eating at the same time when you have eaten enough. This is the beginning of this refutation of the proof that the good is not identical with the pleasant. Now, how is Kallikrishna's reaction? Let us read the immediate sequel.
No notion what you're quibbling about, Socrates. I'd rather think you do, Callicles. You're only pretending. But let us continue on our forward march, so that you may acquire some notion of what a clever fellow you are to take me to task. Isn't it true that in all of us, both the thirst and the pleasure derived from drinking ceases simultaneously? I've no notion what you mean, I tell you. Gorgias. Don't say that.
Gorgias speaking now, after a long time of silence, yes?
Don't say that, Callicles. Answer him for our sake also, so we may properly come to the end of the argument.
They're not quite, so that the speeches may find their completion.
Okay.
Yeah. Go on.
But Socrates is always like this, Gorgias. He keeps on asking piffling little questions until he's got you. What's that to you? Your reputation is not at stake. Just let Socrates refute you in any way he likes.
And
well then.
Yes, now what does this mean? Gorgias is eager to hear the secret. And Callicles obeys him. Gorgias has authority over Callicles. This much is clear, but something which is more important. The dialogue is continued for the sake of Gorgias. And there is further evidence than the secret. I only took the first example of that. Now Socrates reminds Callicles of the fact that Callicles' whole argument is based on the distinction between superior and inferior, better and worse men. And Callicles did not mean by better men, men who have more pleasures, and worse men, men who have less pleasures. But the better men are those who possess or lack the ability to procure the pleasures for themselves. And then he gives some in 497e following, where he shows that especially in the case of courage or its opposite, cowardice, it is by no means true that the more courageous men have more pleasures than the cowards. And but on the contrary, so that, in other words, a manly man, a better man, is not distinguished from a worse man by having more pleasures. From Callicles' principle that the good is pleasant, cowardice would have to prefer to a manliness. Well, the cowards get much more excitement from life than solidly brave men, and of course, therefore, also more pleasant reliefs. I mean, a man who is constantly in fear, and many of these fears prove to be unfounded, has lots of pleasures which the courageous man lacks. Now, the self-contradiction of Callicles consists in this. If the good is identical with the pleasant, the only thing which counts is a pleasant life. Whether this pleasant life is due to one's power or ability, or to mere luck or accident, would not make any difference. But for Callicles, it does make a difference. He genuinely admires the hombre. And there is a contradiction between this admiration for the hombre, this concern with his resplendent, grand, beautiful, noble, and his hedonism. If Callicles did not have this admiration, he could not be refuted. He could not be reached by logos, by argument. A man who knows of nothing but of the satisfaction of his desire for food and drink could not be refuted. This is of some interest with a view to the present so-called social science relativism. All values are subjective. Whether you take the filling of your belly, or whether you take something admirable, doesn't make any difference. The only question is, can a man who truly believes this, and not merely says he believes it, be a social scientist? Can he understand human beings? Can he understand himself as a scientist without seeing in science, in reason, something high? And must he therefore not be open to the question whether there are not other things which are also high, namely intrinsically superior to filling one's belly? But this only in a passing. Let us turn to 499b.
But the good...
This is the speech of Callicles.
It's quite a time now, Socrates, that I've been listening to you while I spoke my agreeable answers, perfectly well aware that if for a joke everyone gives you a hint, you'll seize upon it with childish glee, as if you really believed that I or anyone else in the world didn't realize that some pleasures are better and some worse.
Yes. Now, Callicles says, now, why do you take all these troubles, Socrates? It's wholly unnecessary, as far as I'm concerned. But why did Callicles not say so earlier, and would have saved the trouble? Well, on the earlier occasion, he acted as a manly man. He defended his whole territory, didn't budge. Now, he abandoned some territory with grace. And this is an entirely different thing that is becoming. You are a child, Socrates. In other words, he claims he has fooled Socrates, and that means that he has been victorious in spite of that reputation. This reveals, of course, his character. Calicles grants now that there are bad pleasures. This is, of course, not necessarily incompatible with hedonism, because bad pleasures can simply be pleasures which are followed by pains, and therefore the desirable pleasures are the pure pleasures, pleasures not followed by pain. That will also be discussed in Voltaire. But Socrates argues here in a different way. If there are bad pleasures, hence we cannot take our bearings by the pleasant, but only by the good. Because the fact that something is pleasant is not a sufficient reason for choosing it, because it may be a bad pleasure. Therefore, there is a radical difference between the good and the pleasant, and we have to take our bearings by the good alone. Now, Socrates developed then the consequences of this regarding rhetoric, even regarding the whole life. Let us turn to 500a, the speech of Socrates.
Let us then recall my remarks to Polus and Gorgias. If you remember, I said that some activities were concerned solely with pleasure, procured this only, and paid no attention to what might be better or worse, and there were others which recognized good and evil. Among those concerned solely with pleasure, I put gourmet cookery as a knack, not an art. And among those concerned with the good, I set medicine as an art. And now, by the love of friendship, Callicles, please don't think that you ought to play with me, or that your answers should be at random or contrary to your true opinion. On the other hand, don't take what I say as a joke either. You do see, truly, that our conversation is on the subject which should engage the most serious attention of anyone who has a particle of intelligence. In what way should one live one's life? Should it be the one to which you...
No more general question and more fundamental question for man's life is thinkable. How should one live? But this question is immediately specified insofar as it is asserted that there is only one fundamental alternative. Yes.
Should it be the one to which you urge me as being the activity which best befits a man, speaking in public, practicing rhetoric, engaging in politics in the current fashion? Or should it be this present life of mine immersed in philosophy? And what is the difference between the two of them? Perhaps the best way to discover this is to begin with the distinction I attempted to make a little while ago. When we have made it and agreed upon the fact that these two lives are actually distinct, we must inquire what the difference is and which one of them we should choose to live. It is possible that you do not yet catch my meaning. I certainly don't.
Now, what is the alternative stated here? Either the present political life, which means life in a democracy, or the philosophic life. Now, this clearly does not exclude the possibility that there may be another kind of political life which is compatible with philosophy. Rhetoric is presented here as belonging to the present political life, meaning as simply bad, as you have seen. But it is still a question whether the distinction between the two ways of lives is valid. Now, the question is next presumed to have been settled in the discussion with Polus. Let us see, we come most gradually to the key point in 501d. Socrates repeats again, these sham arts, flatteries or knacks, consist in merely gratifying men instead of improving either their bodies or souls. Yes? Is this Is this true the case of a single soul?
Yes, and does this hold for one soul only, and not for two or more? Oh no, it holds for two and for many more. Then is it possible to gratify a large crowd all together at the same time without taking into consideration what is best?
Without taking into any consideration would be the least one would have to say. Yes?
Yes, I imagine so. Can you tell me then what activities there are that indulge this practice? Or rather, if you please, when I ask you, if you think one of them belongs to this class, say so. If not, say no. First, let us think of flute playing. Does it not seem to you, Callicles, that it seeks our pleasure only and has no other object? Yes, I think so.
Now, then there come a number of other arts of the same kind, a kindred kind. And at the end of it, in 502b, this is a culmination.
And what about the effort of that stately marvel, tragic poetry? Is all her aim and concern merely to gratify the audience? Or does she also strive not to make any pronouncement which, though it may be pleasant and delightful, is also bad? Does she boldly sing out what is useful, though unpleasant, whether the audience likes it or not? Which attitude do you believe to be displayed by tragic poetry? Why, it seems quite obvious, Socrates, that the effort is rather toward pleasure and the gratification of the spectator.
Well, in other words, the case of rhetoric is in a way changed by this remark, because the status of rhetoric is apparently not different, not inferior to that of poetry, and even to that noble kind of poetry, tragedy. The problem of rhetoric appears now in a very different light. Of course, someone can say that's not surprising. We all have read Plato's Republic and the criticism of poetry there. But this is only a reference from one unknown to another, because we would have to know what this criticism means. So, on the contrary, Socrates will make clear in the sequel that tragedy is even lower than rhetoric. Now, that is in 502d. Rhetoric is a kind is speaking to the people, to the demon.
Poetry is a kind of public address, so it seems. Should consequently be a rhetorical kind of public address. You do think, do you not, that poets make use of rhetoric in their plays? I do. Then we have now hit upon a kind of rhetoric addressed to a crowd of people made up of men and women and children alike, of slaves as well as free men. We are not able to admire it very much because we maintain that it is a form of flattery. Quite good. What then is the nature of the rhetoric addressed to the people of Athens and of the other cities of free men? Does it seem to you that orators always speak with an eye on what is best and aim at this, that their fellow citizens may receive the maximum improvement through their words? Or do they, like the poets, strive to gratify their fellows, and, in seeking their own private interest, do they neglect the common good, dealing with public assemblies as though the constituents were children, trying only to gratify them, and caring not at all whether this procedure makes them better or makes them worse?
So tragedy, in a way the highest form of poetry, is lower than rhetoric, because tragedy is addressed to children, women, and slaves as well as to freemen, whereas rhetoric addresses itself only to freemen. You see here, when he says here at the beginning of the passage which you now read, some kind of rhetoric. This is already a key point. There are various kinds of rhetoric. Contrast this with the blanket condemnation of rhetoric in the Polo section. And there is also a new criterion, as we have seen now here. The political rhetoric gratifies the hearers for the sake of private gain of the orator. One could, of course, ask, wonder, could there not be a political orator who gratifies the demons, yet at the same time thinks of the common good? Why this extremism, that the pleasant and the good cannot possibly come together? Let us read the reply of Callicles, which follows immediately.
This question you were asking is no longer a simple one. There are, in fact, some orators who say what they say with deep concern for their fellow citizens, but there are also others such as you describe.
And you see, now Callicles is again entirely sincere, I mean, because he is interested in politics, there is no question. He replies not merely for the sake of Gorgias, and he doesn't play with Socrates. He takes the side of the decent public spirit of orators, contrary to what he implied in his long speech regarding the true hombre. This is the genuine Callicles. What is behind this self-contradiction? Public spiritedness is concerned with the common good of the city of Athens, ordered democratically, because that is the context in which he would work. Therefore, he must have love for the Athenian demos, as Socrates says he has. Again, we must understand this in the sense of collective selfishness, right or wrong, my city. And now then there is this proclivity from collective selfishness to private selfishness is understood here. You know, it's someone, at first glance, a patriotic public spirit of citizen has nothing in common with a man concerned only with his private gain. But from a stricter point of view, they have very much in common, because they do not allow of any principle higher than selfishness, collective or private. The mere patriot, in the sense of right or wrong my country, is a much more respectable man than a merely selfish one. But he doesn't have the root of the matter in himself, and therefore his proclivity. As this is beautifully developed in Thucydides, if one reads him properly, the tyrant city Athens, the imperialist city, and its connection with tyranny pure and simple. Now let us consider the sequel, where we left off.
That's good enough. For if this matter is really twofold, part of it will doubtless be a form of flattery and a shameless method of addressing the public. The other may well be beautiful, a genuine attempt to make the souls of one's fellows as excellent as may be, a striving always to say what is best, whatever the degree of pleasure or pain it may afford the audience. But a rhetoric such as this you have never encountered. Or, if you are able to mention such an orator, why have you not already told me his name? Well, I swear I can't name a single one, at least among the orators of today. Are you then able to mention any of the older statesmen through the influence of whose public career the Athenians became better than they were before? For my
part, stop here. This will then be taken up later, where Socrates says that these men of the past, the great men, Themistocles and Pericles, Cimon and Miltiades, were also bad. And the most radical condemnation of all the glories of the city of Athens. This is here already prepared. But we must not over, and this is a very sensational piece in the Gorgias, but we must not overlook the key event which has suddenly taken place in 503a. And Socrates admits now for the first time that there can be a rhetoric which is a genuine art. And the question, and we know already its general purpose, it must make men better, the citizens better. But he also says this noble rhetoric does not, at least not yet, exist. What is the consequence? But it is obviously possible, it seems. What must we do? If it does not yet exist.
Make it.
Pardon?
You must make it.
You must make it. And then the question, surely, and then but who will make it? Who will make it? Oh, it must be a man of some of some great gifts, obviously. But who? Who is the most likely candidate? Pardon? Sugaris, in this case. Yes. Now, what must he be able to do? What, after all, we must see whether he can do it. How could we test Sugaris' ability to produce a true and noble rhetoric? I mean, he must be able to make the Athenians, and especially, of course, the politically active Athenians, better. Now, here in this dialogue, we see him attempting to make such a man better. And namely Callicles. Polus is of no interest because Polus is a foreigner, but Callicles is an Athenian. And what does Sokrates achieve in his conversation with Callicles?
Deadline.
Yeah, he silences him. Yeah. He can easily refute him, but he does not make any dent. So Socrates clearly fails. I mean, if he cannot refute Callicles, who is relatively well intentioned towards Socrates and not an abominable character, so only very confused. What will happen in the many other cases? So Sugaris, I'm afraid, will not fill the bill. But there is someone here who, to whom Callicles listens more than to Sugaris. Gorgias. What about Gorgias? The whole dialogue is made for Gorgias. Sugaris, we can say, while Gorgias' rhetoric is not exhibited, and not even Gorgias' view of rhetoric is exhibited, Sugaris' rhetoric and his view of rhetoric are exhibited. And they are exhibited in the Callicles section, at any rate, as not sufficient. Could it not be that the purpose of the dialogue as a whole is to say to Gorgias, this is a kind of thing you should do, instead of the wholly frivolous things which you are doing now? I mean, he wrote, for example, a praise of Salt and a praise of Helen, this ambiguous woman. But if he would make an other kind of speeches, which would have an effect on the Athenian demos, or at least on its leaders, then it would be something useful. In other words, if this is so, and I believe that is the case, then the dialogue would present in a clear manner the limitations of the Socratic art. What Sokrates says that indicates by stating that he is only good at dialogue, short speeches, as distinguished from long speeches. The public, public oratory is important. Now, there is one particular case, I would like to mention this now, of a rhetoric which is especially important. At the end of the dialogue, we have a myth. This myth, however, is explicitly said to be not a myth, mythos in Greek, but a logos. And whatever this may mean, it surely means it is simple truth and not imagery. And this, describes the punishment of the wicked after death. And the speech is rather, doesn't have the slightest effect on Kalinas. But the question is, could not other men other than Socrates, could not, say, this famous orator and rhetorician Gorgias perhaps produce fear-inspiring speeches, inspiring fear of hell, which would induce men like Callicles, or could induce men like Callicles to that. Socrates could not do that. It is beyond his power. This lesson the dialogue conveys. Now, yes, I think it's of no use to go on. Would someone of you like to bring up one or the other point? Mr. Dryer.
A test of the extent of Socrates' ability would be whether or not Gorgias would catch on. How would we be able to determine whether Socrates' rhetoric would be effective to the point of teaching Gorgias the proper kind of
thing. Yeah, well, that is a very good question. And Plato has therefore given us the answer. Plato is a very decent writer. He does not create difficulties for us, which he does not enable us to solve, that I mean. You know, otherwise it would just be tricky. It is sometimes not easy to do that, and one has to know quite a few things which not everyone knows. But in this case it is simple, because there is a sequel to the Gorgias, we can say, a dialogue Meno, in which we see what Gorgias did afterward. He did not obey Socrates' suggestion. So, in other words, it is a gamble, an open for the future, that sometime someone with the gifts of Gorgias and with the modesty which Gorgias doesn't have, namely to do what Socrates tells him. It is the same problem, exactly the same problem as regarding poetry in the Republic. Apparently poetry is condemned, unqualified, in the 10th book, even more than in the 2nd or 3rd book. And yet, if one thinks a bit about it and reads more carefully, one sees that poetry is not simply condemned. But it is only condemned if it claims to be autonomous. If it is in the service of philosophy, if it is ministerial to philosophy, then it is all right. The same is true of rhetoric. But where do you find poets who are willing to minister to philosophy? Not in our age. In the past, there were some. So many great. Dante is the most obvious example. But there were also others. But at any rate, the problem is fundamentally the same in the fact that Plato, or rather Socrates, shifts here the issue from rhetoric to poetry and back, shows that we are confronted with the same problem. Yes?
Why do you think Gorgias' view isn't fully brought out by Plato?
Here, that is not a matter of what you call now thinking, but a matter of brute fact.
No, I mean, what is the reason Plato doesn't bring fully
out? The whole issue, the complete issue of rhetoric the full issue of rhetoric is not brought out. We have, for example, the very important question of legitimate forensic rhetoric, without which we could never understand Socrates' own apology. A general rule. First I have to say something to explain away what I meant by general. I mean, there is only a small number of Platonic dialogues which I believe I have understood. I do not believe that there is anyone now living who can claim more than that. I mean, he may understand other dialogues much better than I do, but I don't believe there is a single one in the world who can claim that he has understood all dialogues as they must be understood. Therefore, when one makes a general rule, I must always say, on the basis of my limited experience, we cannot help that. The term which is ordinarily used in social science is that you have to make hypotheses. You can also, but this word has been so grossly abused that I try to avoid it. Now then, after this explanation, I say then that a general rule that in every Platonic dialogue, something very important for the subject matter of the dialogue is disregarded, is abstracted from. And it's the understanding of the dialogue, the adequate understanding, would consist in seeing what is abstracted from and why it is abstracted from. For instance, in the dialogue Euthyphro, the word soul never occurs, although it is necessary in given passages that it should occur. It would be the natural word. A word which Plato frequently used. The question arises why. I could answer that question in the case of Euthyphro, it would lead us too far. In the case of the Republic, I believe I have shown that there is a certain abstraction from Eros, characteristic of the Republic. Not that it is not mentioned there, it is mentioned, but it is played down. To mention one point, when Socrates speaks there of the needs which induce men to enter society, the perpetuation of the species is not mentioned. The tyrant, the injustice incarnate, is called Eros incarnate. It's this kind of thing. And I have tried to explain that. Here in the Gorgias we see a whole dimension is abstracted from, and the disregard of these forms of rhetoric, which are so obviously necessary, even after all deliberative rhetoric is necessary if you want to have a republic and commonwealth, the extremism of the Gorgias, its radicalism, the complete separation of the philosophic life from the political life and no combination of the two. This is the point one would have to understand. And I think we will be able to make some progress into that when we study the brother or sister dialogue, the Protagoras. In the third paragraph, now let me see. Did I not? Yeah, in the I converse with him. Do you have that in the second, or third sentence? I converse with him.
I converse with him. I immerse all my powers in his divine essence. I am overwhelmed by his kindness. I bless him and his gifts, but I do not pray to him. What should I ask of him?
Yeah, he doesn't pray. That's very characteristic. Doesn't pray. This was, it's very characteristic for other things in the 18th century. Kant, for example, fundamentally a religious philosopher, rejects prayer as, how does he call it, lip service, you know, do the right thing, fulfill God's demands, you know, prayer. Pardon? Yeah?
I was curious when you said that the vicar's principles would lead to an entirely different education of Emile. How does Rousseau expect Emile to believe this religion, given the fact that he was educated according to Rousseau's principles?
Because now, that we explain, there is a formal explanation, I mean, we have discussed that. Children understand only bodily and sensible things, yeah? But then he gradually grows up. He studies mathematics, for example, and these are not simply sensible things, yeah? Mathematical objects, circles, numbers, and so on. But they are related, essentially, to sensible things. And then he gradually learns also of certain concepts which can no longer have a direct sensible representation. And then once he has reached that stage, he can understand such things as spirit.
What I mean is this, if won't Emile see that if this religion were true, his education should have been different?
No, under no circumstances must he see that, because it would mean destroying the trust in his teacher. No, that's impossible. But he must really take it to mean that no. But there is, of course, there is a statement. Did we not read a statement where he says that up to a certain point he educated him with guile and force, and from now on he couldn't talk?
That's later.
Later, yeah. We may take some. Let us first consider the last statement we have to see on page 257, bottom.
In my well-founded self-distrust, the only thing that I ask of God, or rather expect from his justice, is to correct my error if I go astray, if that error is dangerous to me. To be honest, I need not think myself infallible. My opinions, which seem to me true, may be so many lies. For what man is there who does not cling to his own beliefs? And how many men are agreed in everything? The illusion which deceives me may indeed have its source in myself, but it is God alone who can remove it. I have done all I can to attain to truth, but its source is beyond my reach. Is it my fault if my strength fails me and I can go no further? It is for truth to draw near to me.
Yeah, in other words, he admits that his firmest opinions may be lies. So this is only another way of saying what Rousseau says. They are exposed to insoluble objections. Yes, opposed to objections. Now it would be impossible to take up today the assignment of Mr. Nagorsky. We'll do it next time. We can easily do it because next time's assignment, for which we'll have a paper by Mr. Hartman and Mr. Boyd, is very relatively short, and so we will have time for that. I have not here that reference. That is very bad. The conflict comes out very clearly. I mean, the conflict between Rousseau and the Savoyard vicar. I should have made a note here, which I didn't do.
In the reverie.
Now let me see if you can be a bit patient with me. I might be able to find it. It is really not. Yeah, and anyway, there is a statement where the editor, who is a very sensible editor, Marcel Raymond of the Reverie de Premier Solitaire, admits when Rousseau says that there is a glaring contradiction between the teaching of providence presented in the very Reveries in the earlier chapter and what he says later about the blind necessity. The blind necessity which rules the fate of man. Unfortunately, I cannot find this remark. Here it is. Oh, at the end of the second promenade, on the contrary, Rousseau regarded his sufferings and the proscription of which he was the object as a providential fact. And here I can perhaps find where that is. It is note 67, to which it belongs. Where is that? I'm sorry. Well, that is in a later. That is somewhere in the seventh promenade. These statements occur. So there is no question that. But please don't misunderstand me. These things require a much closer study that we can possibly give here in a single seminar. It is perfectly. I would be satisfied if every one of you would regard it as possible, not more, that Rousseau's opinion may not be identical with the opinion of the Savoyard vicar. You see, afterwards, partly in the reply to the Archbishop of Paris, and partly in the Letters of the Mountains, Rousseau identifies himself with the profession of Savoyard vicar. But this was an entirely different situation. The profession of the Savoyard vicar was regarded by public opinion as unbearable. You know? Now, so the least he could do was to return to that relatively bearable position, in spite of its unbearability, compared to the other position, so to speak, to the left in political of the Savoyard vicar. Did I make myself clear? No? Well, left I meant more remote from other. Here is the Savoyard vicar. And here is Jean-Jacques. Now, this Rousseau regarded as publicly defensive, otherwise he couldn't have written. Now, if it proved to be create a European scandal, the least he could do is to identify himself with that, and not to say, well, this is only a weak inkling of what I truly think. You know, it is really hard for anyone. I have done some work in former times in the 18th century, but even I have always difficulties in understanding the very severe restrictions which existed. You must not forget a book which is today admired, and not without reason, as a document of sobriety and conservatism and moderation, like Montesquieu's Spirit of Laws, could not be cut, and he was a high official, in Bordeaux, and a very respected man. He couldn't publish this with his name, the title page, or in France. It was published anonymously in Geneva. And the other people, these famous atheists and materialists, Holbach and Lemaître, they published their things, of course, anonymously in Holland. The Dutch had in that time a very bad reputation among pious Christians. In your country, for a special reason, because they seem to have taken over in 1688, you remember that. And whether they had all kinds of nasty things about the Dutch, where the spirit of trade seemed to be more powerful than any pious consideration, which of course was unjust to the Dutch, but had a certain plausibility undeniable. And now, great potentate who was very liberal was Frederick the Great. You know, very great. He was a friend of Voltaire and like that D'Alembert and all the other people. He was very free. And the estates of Frederick the Great were the only place where Rousseau could find a refuge in Neuchâtel, which in Switzerland at that time belonged to the Prussian Crown, apart from England, of course, where he could go. In England, there was a relatively great freedom of publication, but in the continental countries it didn't exist except in Prussia, under Frederick the Great. And one sees it also the way in which they, I mean, there were people who were regarded as the most notorious men, and these were Hobbes and Spinoza. And it is quite interesting to see how, I mean, they are not frequently mentioned, yeah? I mean, except by adversaries. Hobbes was a bit better off than Spinoza, but Spinoza was referred to, as most people said approvingly, that he led apparently an innocent life in spite of his terrible convictions. And in Germany, the first statement in favor of Spinoza, his philosophy, was published in 1785. That's very much 23 years later. And one must always take this into consideration as a background. Of course, in each particular case, a particular investigation is necessary. Now, in the case of Rousseau, we have quite some almost direct evidence, his explicit discussion of the question of sincerity in writings. In the not only in the Reverie is the most coherent, but there are other statements also in other places, and I don't see any other way in which one can account for the difficulties.
There's one thing, I see your rule as interpretation as being very sound for the things that are very definitely defense, which we saw to Beaumont and the letters from the mountain things. But the Reveries, I wonder about, because of the fact that he begins the whole thing by saying that this is, you know, his last work, and it's something that he doesn't really care whether they're published or not. And then the other one is
but it could be published, could it not? I mean, if you're sure, after all, he did not.
But it was really too late at that time for him to. Except the fact that he wanted to live beyond his time.
Sure, but it would discredit. An open statement of his position would, of course, have discredited his whole work. I mean, that Rousseau and even his most daring things became acceptable to a large body of opinion through the French, to the victory of the French Revolution, he could not foresee. As a situation, and in addition, on the basis of the French Revolution, how, to what extent was Rousseau truly understood? When you read the general literature on Rousseau, that is only a kind of, I mean, the very crudest things, the doctrines of the social contract and so, they are of course not, but for his attitude toward religion, I think it is only the most massive things are clear that he, like his criticism of revealed religion. And this, of course, were points which had been stated amongst these Englishmen, Collins and so, the so-called English deals. I have never read them, so I don't know how far they went. But that was after Rousseau's death that this issue was discussed in Germany. That was in the 1770s. A very well-known man, a professor of philosophy, Reimarus was his name, had written, he had published only works on natural theology, you know, which was permissible and all that. But then he had written also a critique of revelation, both in general and also about of the miracles of the Old Testament and the New Testament. And this he had finished and completed, but he didn't publish it. He did not speak about it even to her who slept at his bosom, as they called it in the language of the ancients. And then his children, however, after his death, gave it to a famous German writer, Lessing, and Lessing published it, concealing the identity of the author with a view to the good reputation of the children.
Is this the Laocoon?
No, Laocoon is it deals with painting and with painting and poetry. No, no. And this created an incredible scandal. In this late 70s. So that, I mean, today nothing creates any scandal anymore. I mean, we cannot, so I think the last great scandal, if I see correctly, was Darwin. This, because the biblical criticism, which came, some of which came later, was not such, didn't create that uproar, which Darwin created. And I mean, today, anything, I mean, was there any outcry on religious grounds when psychoanalysis appeared? I'm not aware of it. I mean, there may have been individual critics, but I don't believe a general protest. And I think what I'm driving at is this. This has in itself nothing to do with the philosophic truth or not, with a mere historical truth, that in reading authors, say prior to the 19th century on the European continent, and prior to the 18th century, in everywhere, including England, one has to consider the possibility of deliberate concealment. In some cases, one can pursue it, one can observe it in detail, for example, the case of Hobbes, where one can make, that is easy to show, Hobbes' theological views are a function of the established order. For example, up to in 1640, he still said episcopacy is a divine right institution. Later in that year, episcopacy was abolished by the Long Parliament. Therefore, in the next book which Hobbes published, in 1642, episcopacy was no longer a divine right institution. Now, his most daring book from his point of view is a Leviathan, published in 1651 under Cromwell, when all heresies laws were abolished. And there he had a legal right to say anything he wanted. And he went very far. And then when after the Restoration, when he brought out the Latin Leviathan in 1668, he retracted